Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. I want to begin by celebrating that, as most of you know, the theme songs for the show are by Sparks, that movie, Annette, that they made with Leos Carax, has recently been released. I hope you're all seeing it. Sparks has been a part of the show since many years ago, but also part of the show for many years is the magnificent writer Richard Powers. Today, we're going to talk about his new novel, Bewilderment. It's his 13th novel. Am I right, Richard?
That's right. And my fourth time on the show.
And the fourth time on the show. We've done events publicly together. We've had the privilege of being together with David Foster Wallace. We've eaten meals together. It's been a rare pleasure to know Richard Powers from his very first book onward. That first book was recommended to me by my teacher and mentor and really father figure, John Barth. The book was Three Farmers on Their Way to a Dance. And now with me is my guest, the beloved Sean Sullivan, who is one of the two major colleagues who work on Bookworm with me. I'm privileged to have them. After all these years, I actually have colleagues who read Alan Howard and who read and write Sean Sullivan. Hello, Richard.
Hello, Michael. It's so lovely to hear your voice. I wish we were sitting in the same room together. I hope we will before too long, but it's lovely to be back even just by voice.
And when I discovered how much Sean Sullivan loved this book, he had never read you before. So I thought, well, it's time for someone to teach me new things about talking to you.
Hello, Richard. And so it's an honor and a pleasure, although it's true that Bewilderment was the first novel of yours I read, and I adored it. I had first encountered you on e-books. Books on the phone was a thing that I was interested in. And I'd read a short of yours that was introduced in that format, which was Janie, is how I first read you. Do you remember Janie?
Oh, yeah, I do remember that. I haven't thought of that short story in a long time.
I was deeply affected by Bewilderment. I enjoyed it so much. Immensity of it really touched me as I was reading it. And you get introduced to it right away. For example, in the first chapter, Theo and his son Robin are speaking about life in, elsewhere in the universe and if it exists. And so Robin is 9 years old. Theo is describing Robin. And he says, synthetic clothing gave him hideous eczema. His classmates harassed him for not understanding the vicious gossip. His mother was crushed to death when he was 7. His beloved dog died of confusion a few months later. And really the emotional magnitude is introduced to me right then. And I know that the title of the book is Bewilderment. And in the beginning, there's a wonderful note from the author in which you describe that bewilderment is known as meaning perplexed or confused, but you refer to its etymology as wildness. Is it within our nature as human beings to feel confused about ourselves and the enormity of who we are?
Oh, what a lovely way to start talking about the book. I was thinking as you were speaking about this question, you use the word immensity, about this question of scale and size in literature. And Bewilderment follows a novel in my creation. It follows The Overstory, which was a much longer book and a much more panoramic and epic book in some ways. It had a far larger cast. There were at least 9 principal characters. Bewilderment is less than half the length of that book. Maybe, I don't know, maybe closer to a third of the length of the Ower story. And it deals almost exclusively with 2 lost boys, a father and a son. And in that regard, its initial presentation is as something much smaller. I felt when I was working on the novel, almost like a composer who had completed a large scale symphony and was now turning to the smallest kind of chamber work, a piano sonata or a string quartet, and you know, almost on the other side of the spectrum of scale, as far on the other side of the spectrum of scale as I could get. But oddly, it kind of turned into what the science fiction people like to call a pocket universe, something that is bigger on the inside than the out. And Sean, you were right. The book opens with a kind of little glimpse of the cosmos before it settles into this father-son story. And then by the end of the book, it opens back outwards into the cosmos. And it's punctuated along the way by these visits to other planets. This travel backwards and forwards between the very large and the very small, the microscopic and the telescopic, is really at the heart of the book for me. That word bewilderment has been a favorite of mine for many years, and it often came up in interviews when I was discussing my work. I first fell in love with it when I came across it in an essay by the great physician essayist Lewis Thomas. And he wrote a beautiful essay called On Matters of Doubt. And he was looking for a way across the two cultures, you know, C.P. Snow's famous 2 cultures, the cultures of science and the culture of the arts and humanities. And he's saying, I need something that can be the common denominator between all the cultures of human effort, you know, whether they are intellectual in nature or emotional in nature. And he said, I think I found the one thing that underwrites all of human endeavor. And he says, that thing is bewilderment. My discovery of a remarkable technique called decoded neurofeedback, in which people train in real time to imitate the recorded patterns of another person's brain, reminded me of the great science fiction short story and later novel by Daniel Keyes called Flowers for Algernon. And when I went back to look at Flowers for Algernon, I saw that Keyes had used as an epigraph a quote from Plato's Republic, from the famous allegory of the cave. And in the most famous English translation of the allegory of the cave, the passage goes something like, the eye knows 2 kinds of bewilderment, going into the light and coming out of it. And there I thought, well, I can finally, after all these years, write a novel called Bewilderment and travel from the tiny to the expansive and back again.
I'm talking, by the way, to Richard Powers. We're talking about his new novel, Bewilderment, which is published very well by Norton. And joining me is my colleague, Sean Sullivan. Is there such a thing as a child who is not a special child? I don't think so. Robin, who is, after all, dealing with his mother's death 2 years ago, and then his beloved dog's death, which allows him to express his grief because he'd kept it guarded from his father at his mother's death. This boy, this Robin, is a special child, and the doctor is trying to put him, quote unquote, on the spectrum, you know, on the spectrum of disturbed children. We have all kinds of spectrums now, But what Richard Powers points out in this book is that we are all on the spectrum. To be human is to be on the spectrum. And one of the things that the book says so beautifully, as my associate Sean Sullivan has pointed out to me, all of us fail, but the mother says some of us, we fail when we fail.
Fall beautifully.
We all fail beautifully.
This is the story about a man, a scientist, an astrobiologist, who loses his beloved wife and who's left alone raising a child who is, I guess the word that we would use now, neurodivergent. And it's a love story between the father and the son. It's a love story and a ghost story for the missing wife who's gone too soon. It's also a love story between a boy and the living world. Robin is deeply in love with the non-human world. He's a kind of pantheist. God is everywhere in other living things. And it is that intense love that he feels for the more than human world that also produces his grief and his anger and his anxiety when he learns how quickly that world is disappearing and what we're doing with it.
In the course of the book, you brought back to my mind, one, that you were a lost boy, two, that I am a lost boy, and three, that all of our readers of this book deserve to be put back into the memory of having emerged from being lost children. Some of us are still. I know that I am still. I suspect that you are still.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a word that I came across quite often while writing over story. I don't know if it will finally gain traction and become go into common parlance. But, and in fact, I've never heard the word pronounced out loud. I imagine it's pronounced soul nostalgia, but it's a word coined for this grief that we're feeling now for the world that's disappearing and the world that has already disappeared, the diminishment of the living world that children feel so intensely.
Please say the word again.
Soul nostalgia.
Wow, that's a beautiful word.
Yeah, it's a neologism, of course. And the notion is that we somehow are feeling a homesickness for a place that we may never have seen in the case of a nine-year-old boy. You know, when he turns to his father and says, "Is this really happening? And why are you letting it happen?" The father doesn't have a ready answer. And that's what drives the tragedy of the story forward.
One thing that's introduced to Robin throughout the book is experimental neurofeedback and brain scans. My favorite word for it, which comes from the book, is self-modulating therapy. And this is a connection to Flowers for Algernon as well. And so this is chosen over psychoactive drugs. Because Theo, I think, very rightly says, who gives psychoactive drugs to a nine-year-old? And he's looking for another process to deal with his personality. But I wonder, in the greater vision of things, does this therapy seem more harmful or helpful to him?
It's based on something called decoded neurofeedback, which has been explored now for over a decade. It basically involves taking a real-time fMRI images of people who are engaged in certain activities or are learning things or who are experiencing certain emotional states and saving those in a recording, almost like a digital video. And then training other people who are also being watched in real time using fMRI to approximate the mental states of the recording that have been recorded. And when I first read about that, you know, the hairs on the back of my neck stood up. because I thought this is like telepathy. This is like some kind of opening of the locked room. It's going to be if it ever reaches maturity, it's going to be a kind of process that might help us answer that old, endless philosophical question of what does it feel like to be another person or another kind of creature. But my book is what the science fiction writers would call a near future novel, or maybe better in this case, a near present. It's set on an almost Earth, but it's also not quite the world that we've just come through. And this therapy, again, becomes something not quite like what it is in the real world. It becomes the way into the fable. It becomes a way into this question of, could this boy actually learn through the recordings that were made of his mother what his mother was like, what she thought and felt? And in this sense, this empathy machine becomes his stepping stone, the boy's stepping stone, into realizing that he isn't alone, that he is connected to something much larger than himself.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to KCRW's Bookworm. We're talking with Richard Powers, one of my very favorite living writers. His new novel is Bewilderment, and Sean Sullivan, who acts as one of the colleagues on Bookworm, and I are speaking with him together. We'll continue after this short break.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Richard Powers about his new novel, Bewilderment, which looks at what life can and can't be on our planet and elsewhere. Now, Richard, this empathy machine had so much meaning to me. Let's make sure listeners understand the mother, before her death, has spent time in the empathy machine and even perhaps has had an affair with the man who was in charge of this emotional feedback. And so there is a great density of affective possibility to which this special child is exposed. The book moved me to tears again and again, and excited and thrilled me about a potential of human interaction that isn't hypothetical. It's a potential, yes, that exists.
Yes. I would say this book has less science in it than anything that I've ever written. And what science is there mostly to open up the book as a fable and as an intimate portrait of this father and the son. I feel that it operates on the page much more like a domestic, intimate family novel. So I do think of it as a personal novel first and a philosophical speculation second. The boy training to participate in the emotional state of his dead mother is only the start of a process that the reader will come to see by the end of the book as something that he or she is also participating in. That is to say, the act of identifying with this boy, of trying to empathize with this strange, intense, powerful, anxious, but deeply loving child over the course of 200 pages is itself a kind of decoded neurofeedback. The book itself is an empathy machine.
One of the things that I had to say to people for many years is stop identifying and read the book. But in your books, more and more recently, you have provided a model for identification, but suddenly the dog is gone, the mother is gone, and the father is left alone. Now, I identified with the special child. I was a version of this child, but I do not think of him all the time. Your book opened part of my lost soul to me, and I wondered, because that's true in the Overstory too, you are really changing as a writer in relation to what you are doing for your readers and what your readers will come away with. I have not read brilliant novels that reward identification. Identification used to be one of the foolish things that people who were not taught to read properly found themselves needing. But you have moved us into the great beyond. Can you say something?
Michael, bless you. And I'm overwhelmed by that. And I don't really know what to do with such a robust and lovely compliment, but I do feel myself changing as a writer. And it's a strange and wonderful thing that this career, which I started in my 20s, can have lasted for as long as it has. And for me to reach a place where I'm thinking, I'm finally starting to see how this might work, how you drive this thing. And that's not to disown who I was as a younger man, because I think you have to follow the path to see where it goes. And I'm very glad to have written the books that I wrote when I was younger, but I do feel as if the books that I've been writing as an older man are new planets for me. Not only can you continue to work into old age, but you can continue to find ways of changing yourself and find ways of re-exploring the material that intrigued you as a young man and look at it and take it apart from a completely different aesthetic and point of view. I've always shied away from the biographical explanation of fiction, and I've never been a big one for sharing my private details. And in fact, I went for almost 5 books without giving an interview and just trying to keep myself off stage so that the book could speak for itself. But there's something, in this book, there is something very personal. But I also was surprised as I put the story together to gradually discover how much of my own 9-year-old self I was recreating. I was born in 1957. And we didn't do as much diagnosing back then as we do now. I don't know what diagnosis I would have had at 9. And I feel lucky that I had the leeway to be strange, that my family gave that to me, and that all of these things that I pursued with such zeal had some place to be. And that I wasn't corrected out of that with the diagnosis too soon.
We haven't even touched upon the lovely imaginings of other worlds, which are so frequent in the book and so complementary to the narrative tapestry. It's a thing that Theo does for Robin as he imagines life on other worlds and how it's possible. I just want to repeat that it's such an honor and a pleasure to be able to talk with you. And I was deeply touched by Bewilderment, and thank you.
Thanks so much, Sean.
I want my readers to know that what Sean is talking about is that this father takes his son on tours of alternative universes and planets within them. The question being, is human life possible elsewhere? And you see, the question for this child, is human life possible for me after these deaths? after being teased by children. You know, as a special child, they argued about me, whether I should be sent to a school for what used to be called, I can't live with it anymore, retarded children, or whether I should be sent to a school for special children. But no one was thinking of solutions then. To whatever extent we think of solutions now, bewilderment, to my mind, is the answer to the question of how to raise, live with, and benefit a special child. And the book's admiration for the child. I mean, I feel that you projected a father and that you, Richard Powers, was this lost boy. I know that you don't like to get personal, and I also know that you don't have children, but I congratulate you deeply for being able to go so deep into the imagination of what it is to raise a special child. I would like to make sure that my listeners know to read and order Bewilderment right now. I just think this is a meaningful experience for readers today in this very moment to have. It is a book for and of our time. Thank you, Richard Powers.
Thank you, Michael. It has meant so much to me to be with you again and to talk to you and Sean.
It will always mean a lot to me. I've been talking with Richard Powers, author of Bewilderment, published by W.W. Norton & Company. I thank you all for joining me. I want to tell my listeners that due to the pandemic, we are each taping separately, so you may hear and have heard unusual sounds. They're repairing the water mains on my street. And won't you, in the meantime, visit kcrw.com/bookworm for a podcast of today's show, also available at every podcast service that I know of and on demand with KCRW smartphone apps. This has become a global program. If you haven't already, please become a KCRW member. This happens thanks to you, the listeners all over the world who make a show like this possible. Special thanks to my Bookworm show collaborators, Alan Howard and Sean Sullivan, who you've met today, and our great engineer, PJ Shahamat. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
A bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.